Magnolia versus Magnolia Bible Church, Magnolia's First Baptist Church, Believers Fellowship, and Ken Paxton, Attorney General. If we could have the attorneys make their announcements, please.
James Parker for the appellant.
Good morning, Mr.
Bond issue receiving.
Morning, Mr. Parker.
Anthony Lucisano for the appellees, the churches, my colleague Travis Gray.
Natalie Thompson for the attorney general.
Ms. Thompson, can you all tell me what your time allotments are going to be? Have you had the chance to get with the clerk?
We have given Mr. Clerk, Your Honor, 15 and 5 for the law.
Okay, very good.
15 for the churches.
All right. And is the AG going to have any time?
Yes, we'll take 5.
Okay. Okay, very good. This would be a good time if anyone has a cell phone, pager, or other device, reach down and turn it off so we don't disturb our litigants. As I mentioned, the proceedings will be audio recorded and will be on our website shortly. And with that, we will start. Ready for you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. This is a bond validation case under the Expedited Declaratory Judgments Act. And it comes to this court as a challenge to the district court's jurisdiction to grant new trial outside its plenary power. And in this appeal, that's really all that's before the court, the question of whether the district court had jurisdiction to grant new trial. There is no dispute in this case that the city followed the requirements of the Expedited Declaratory Judgments Act to the letter. We filed a petition, and our petition noted that we were filing this lawsuit because various ratepayers objected to the city's water rates. That was no secret. We published notice of the lawsuit and its trial date 4 different times in each of 2 of the largest papers in this state. That was no secret. And before trial, the city talked repeatedly with the Office of the Attorney General about this suit. And specifically, we talked with lead trial counsel for the Attorney General about the churches and about their specific objections. We talked about the issue about whether they should get special individual notice of the trial. The Office of the Attorney General decided at that time that they didn't. So we went to trial. The OAG participated actively in that trial, as the Attorney General is required by the statute to do. And at the end of that trial, the district court granted final judgment. And 30 days after final judgment, the district court's plenary power ended. 4 months after that, it granted new trial. That grant decision granting new trial was erroneous for 3 reasons. First, outside of plenary power, the district court had no jurisdiction either to grant the new trial or to grant leave of court to allow the churches to intervene and participate in trial court proceedings. Secondly, Rule 329 of the Rules of Civil Procedure does not apply to this case or any other EDJA case because its provisions conflict with the procedures set forth in the EDJA. And third, Rule 329 doesn't apply in this case and can't grant a new trial in this case because the churches did not meet their evidentiary burden under that rule to set up a meritorious defense.
Let me ask you, is there any difference in the distinction? You know, when I think of these EDJA cases, there's a bond validation aspect, but then there's also this aspect that a lot of what the churches seem to be challenging is the rate ordinance. Are those treated as one and the same for the EDJA? I mean, it doesn't make sense to me that the rate ordinance would be permanently ensconced in history like a bond validation would be under the EDGA process.
It is, Your Honor, because these are revenue bonds. And so it's not just enough to validate the bonds themselves. The bond market requires that the revenue that's going to repay those bonds, whether it's a contract, as this court dealt with in the SJRA case, or a rate mechanism, as in this case, is also validated. And so, as set forth in the statute, both the public securities themselves and the public security authorizations, which include, in this case, a rate, are validated. And after a judgment validating that, the district court has plenary power for 30 days. And after that 30 days, its plenary power expires, and plenary power is jurisdictional. And jurisdiction is important because the churches certainly have a number of objections to the validity, the enforceability of that judgment. But after 30 days, plenary power expires, and that's jurisdictional. And you can no more go back to that district court that no longer has jurisdiction than you could go to the Admiralty Court of Zanzibar and say that that judgment was no good. Neither court has jurisdiction, and that's the situation that we have here. There are other ways in which other courts would have jurisdiction, and in this case, there are other courts that will have jurisdiction to decide the constitutional questions that the churches raise about that. But that's not this jurisdiction, that's not this district court in this setup.
But doesn't the city claim a res judicata type application of this EDJA towards those claims?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's exactly one way in which I can almost guarantee that the constitutional issues that the churches raise will be adjudicated going forward. As on the record, the court already knows from the record that they have filed suit in Montgomery County. Now, this got consolidated in with this suit. However, if the church if the court did not have plenary power, didn't have jurisdiction to grant new trial or grant leave, it certainly didn't have jurisdiction after plenary power to consolidate that case in, right? So without plenary power, that case gets unconsolidated. It goes to Montgomery County. One of two things is going to happen. Maybe both will happen. We'll seek summary judgment on the basis of res judicata, and the court in Montgomery County will say either, yes, it's res judicata, or no, that's not a good judgment. Either way, that'll go up to the Ninth Court of Appeals, and we'll adjudicate those issues in the Ninth Court of Appeals. By the way, that's exactly the procedural scenario that the Richards versus Jefferson County case on which the churches relied, that's how that got up to the Supreme Court, that exact procedural setup.
Counsel.
Alternatively.
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Will you address the adequacy of the publication service in this case, and does that matter to this court?
Yes, Your Honor. The publication was sufficient. And I don't think there's any dispute on that. The district court found publication to be adequate. We published the original petition twice in the Houston Chronicle and the Austin American Statesman. That's what is required under the EDJA. Then we amended our pleading. We did it over again.
Not in the Magnolia Sun, or what is the Magnolia paper?
I believe that's right, Your Honor. We really belt and suspended this thing and made sure that we had...
Well, Tomball guy, I don't know if we read the Houston Chronicle out there.
Well, I don't know, Your Honor. I think everybody, though, stipulated that it was a newspaper of general circulation in Montgomery County. And so I think there's no dispute that publication was sufficient under the statute. Whether there is a constitutional question, I talked about the res judicata aspect. Also, we can move under 1205.151. This final judgment is a permanent injunction against maintaining that proceeding in Montgomery County. And so we may seek to enforce that injunction, and a future district court here in Travis County may decide either to enforce or say, no, there are constitutional problems with that. I'm not going to enforce this injunction. In either event, in that case, we'll be back before a future third court to discuss those constitutional issues. But because we are outside plenary power in this case, this isn't the right vehicle to do that. That decision was non-jurisdictional. And this court should not render an advisory opinion, certainly not an advisory opinion, on a constitutional issue, either to a future Ninth Court or to its future self in a future case, which may be coming.
Mr. Parker, can I draw your attention to your third reason, which was that 329 doesn't apply because the church didn't meet its meritorious defense?
Yes, Your Honor.
Explain to me, other than the footnote in your brief, because I've read your brief, it's basically just this is a plea to the jurisdiction in the sense of they don't have jurisdiction, and I understand your arguments about plenary power, I understand your arguments about 329 versus EDJA, but if y'all are proposing that they don't have a meritorious defense before challenging the actual, not jurisdiction, I don't think of that as a jurisdiction of the court, I think of that as a maybe abuse of discretion on the judge granting the new trial, wouldn't that need to be brought to us in a mandamus action as opposed to a jurisdictional action?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and we've given some thought to that, actually. Because with outside of 329, If you don't make 329, then the end result is we're just outside of plenary power. And
but
so,
if we were to disagree with you on your argument of 329, to me, where the meritorious defense comes in determining whether the judge should have granted new trial or not.
Yes, Your Honor.
I thought that was your third argument, except I don't see that briefed.
It is, Your Honor, and it is briefed that they did not set up a meritorious defense because they didn't introduce any evidence of a meritorious defense. And so the question is then, if we can't use 329 to get a new trial, whether that is because they didn't set up a meritorious defense or because Rule 329 just doesn't apply in an EDJA case, regardless of the reason we can't use Rule 329, then we're just putting 329 aside, and now we're just left with the fact that we are outside of plenary power. And that means that the district court's without jurisdiction.
So your understanding is that under 329, where it says you need good cause, and we know that good cause is no notice and a meritorious defense.
Yes, Your Honor.
That if we're into that analysis, that is a jurisdictional analysis?
Fundamentally, that is a jurisdictional question. If you can't make the requirements on 329, then 329 is shunted aside. And without 329, then we're just left then with a district court that has no jurisdiction. But in this case, 329 doesn't even apply because it is inconsistent with the EDJA. The churches needed two things. They didn't need just a new trial under Rule 329. And that's all 329 does, is give the court limited jurisdiction to grant new trial. It's not a complete restoration of plenary power. And they needed not just a new trial, they needed leave of court to intervene in this EDJA suit. Because under 1205.062, there's two ways in which a named party, just a member of the public, can become an interested party which participates in the lawsuit. Either show up by the trial date, appear at trial or beforehand, or after the trial date, obtain leave of court to intervene in the lawsuit, to become an interested party. Well, outside of plenary power, the district court doesn't have jurisdiction to grant that leave, to allow them to intervene, to even file a motion for new trial in the first place. And so that, if Rule 329 were to apply, it would set up a catch-22, right? Because as Your Honor pointed out, they need to prove no notice. Well, if they appeared in time in order to intervene, of course they had notice. But if they then had no notice, so that you could do a Rule 329 motion, well, then you're not there in time to intervene. And so it's a catch-22.
Is that not remedied by if there was a motion for new trial granted, they could intervene into that new trial?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
If once the motion for new trial is granted, couldn't they then intervene into that new trial?
Well, right, Your Honor. But first, they have to have leave to intervene in order to even file the motion for new trial. That's the Alejos case, because without that leave of court to intervene, an interested party, a member of the general public, can't even participate in trial court proceedings. And so there's that conflict.
So none of the existing parties were a part of the motion for new trial?
There were no, Your Honor. There was nobody who joined in it. Well, there was no member of the public who intervened in time.
No, I mean the parties who were already in the case.
Right, Your Honor. The Attorney General submitted a filing in support, but did not separately move for new trial, and certainly we didn't ask for new trial. And so the legislature doesn't set up catch-22s. This therefore conflicts. It's inconsistent with the EDJA. And beyond that, the EDJA requirements under 0.068 and 0.151, that a final judgment is final, it's conclusive, it's binding. All of that is inconsistent with a rule that would make a final judgment inconclusive and non-binding and non-final for 2 years later. Because there's an inconsistency, the EDJA controls. Without that, without 329, putting that aside, we're left with no plenary power. And outside of plenary power, the district court had no jurisdiction to grant a new trial. And that decision should be reversed. Now, the churches, I suspect, are going to want to talk not about jurisdiction. They're going to want to jump to that future advisory opinion that the court shouldn't give on a constitutional issue. And when they do that, I hope the court's going to listen for an important thing here.
We're just excited to have something that's not a TCPA motion.
Yes, Your Honor, those are pretty common, but I'll give you the four other EDJ. I'm not sure that's that much more exciting. But on the constitutional issue, listen for what private right, which is to say a right that is rooted in either the Constitution or the common law, not a statutory right, which private right do they say they were deprived of without due process? They'll talk about religious liberty, but the religious liberty issue that they're talking about here is statutory under RFRA. It's not a First Amendment issue. And so it's a public right, and public rights don't get due process. So the question is, what public right were they deprived of, and do they claim they were deprived of without due process? But that's an interesting question, a great coffee shop debate, but it's a coffee house debate, not a courthouse debate, at least in this case, because the district court didn't have jurisdiction to even entertain the discussion.
Mr. Parker, are you going to give us four of these? Was that number one of four?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I just noticed you're out of time. Are you going to go through four, or how are we?
I have
four cases.
Okay.
You made a comment about you had four
issues.
Three issues, Your Honor. And I think I got through them all. Is that plenary power, or outside of plenary power, 329 doesn't apply, and even if 329 did apply, they didn't meet the evidentiary requirements. So,
okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks, sir. Good morning, Mr. Luxano.
May it please the court, Anthony Luchisano on behalf of the churches. What we've heard this morning is about 13 and a half minutes of state procedural arguments, whether the EDJA trumps Rule 329 and how quickly you have to bring a motion for new trial. Now, we of course disagree with them on the merits of all of those arguments, but none of it matters under the Due Process Clause. And I would point the court straight to the heart of it in the In Re ER case. And in that case, the state statute, the time limit, did exactly what the city says the EDJA does here, which is bar any direct or collateral attacks after 6 months. This is section 161.211 of the Texas Family Code. And the movement there.
Counsel, what's the narrowest basis that this court can review the trial court's new trial order? What's the narrowest basis this court can review this on?
I think, Your Honor, it perhaps counterintuitively is the due process grounds, because it's an as-applied challenge on the unique facts of this case, whereas the state law good cause route of Rule 329, which we believe is meritorious as well, requires this court to reconcile the entire EDJA statutory regime with Rule 329 and also raises our constitutional meritorious defenses as well. And so I think if you go down that path, you'll face constitutional questions as well. So I think the avoidance canon doesn't point one way or the other here. The due process question is so important because in In Re ER, a movant under Rule 329, mind you, after the state law expressly barred a motion for new trial, brought that challenge, and yet the Supreme Court entertained it and found a due process violation because the Due Process Clause trumps contrary state procedural limits. The Texas Supreme Court said it about 10 times in the opinion, but I'll just give you a few quotes. Is a state law time limit is unenforceable when it violates due process. Because service was invalid, Family Code Section 161, the challenge bar, does not bar the movement's claims. And so I heard the word jurisdiction plenty of times, but I think the other side fundamentally misunderstands what a void judgment is, in that the precise procedural vehicle or the state time limits do not matter. The Due Process Clause controls. And if you look at In Re ER, you can find about four or five Supreme Court of the United States cases that echo this same principle. So with that, I want to turn to due process, which the court found first and foremost was violated here. I want to point out first, counsel for the other side, when asked Justice Baker about the whether the publication notice was sufficient, turned to state law. Was it sufficient under the EDJA? And I want to urge the court that that's not the question. It's whether it comports with due process. Every single one of these Supreme Court cases we've cited, back to Mullane and Tulsa and Schroeder, every single one of them complied with the state's procedures for newspaper notice. The question was whether under the federal constitution that's sufficient. And that question has two prongs. The first is, did the due process clause attach at all? And the second is, if it did, were the parties here reasonably ascertainable? Here, the churches haven't, or the city has never contested the second prong, and that's because the churches made known their claims about as clearly as you can. They threatened litigation in July of 2018, well before the EDJA action. And so the city wisely doesn't contest that prong. In the last minute of
Council, when the rate increase took effect, why didn't the churches have a duty or responsibility to bring this to court then, rather than basically wait and take a look-see approach?
Well, I want to urge the court that there was diplomatic and civic negotiations going on, hence the letters back and forth urging the city to change courses. I don't think the fact that the churches waited a few more months to file their claim bears on the calculus at all.
Because the churches were still within their limitations period, correct?
Certainly, yes. And again, the problem here is not that the city filed an EDJA action or took the first step. It's that when they did so, they did it with inadequate notice. And that question, because the second prong of that test I laid out is met, hinges purely on the private versus public rights distinction that counsel for the other side mentioned at the end. And that distinction hinges on fundamental characteristics about particularized injuries and standing separate and apart from a generalized taxpayer grievance. And we put out in our brief in page 28 three fundamental characteristics. One is, where does the right come from? Does it come from the mere fact that you're a taxpayer?
And I'm sorry, are you arguing that it is not a public right, that y'all have more than a public right, or are you saying that it's a different analysis regardless of whether it's public or private, and you look at these three different things?
These three characteristics are what distinguish a public right from a private right.
Okay.
And we fall decidedly on the private rights spectrum.
Okay. So you're not arguing, you do not agree that it's a public right?
Certainly not,
okay.
Your Honor. Because the rights at issue here are not merely derived from taxpayer status. In fact, they come from precisely the opposite, which is that these churches are not taxpayers. They are tax-exempt as a subset of the population. And moreover, they've been facially treated differently. I can point you to Clerk's Record 28 is the rate ordinance itself, and it lays out in black and white that there's this separate category of water users that are going to be subject to a disparate rate. So we think this is the quintessential private right, in that the city has decided to treat a subset of its population differently than others, and that has imparted necessarily an injury distinct from the public. The city's definition of a public right has been one that has been a moving target, to put it charitably. In their original brief, they offered the definition that any challenge to any rate is by definition a public right. We pointed out why that's inconsistent with Supreme Court precedent, namely Richards versus Jefferson County, which says that there's something fundamentally different between a taxpayer status claim and a taxpayer's own challenge to an unlawful tax. We also pointed out how that definition would capture fundamentally discrete private discrimination claims. You can look at the hypotheticals on page 29 of our brief involving a rate that just dealt with synagogues or a racial minority or what have you. Clearly, due process applies to those. And so the city, in reply, has pivoted and offered an entirely new theory of what constitutes a public right. They say that private rights are constitutional or common law ones, not statutory ones. That's an odd distinction, because our tax exemption comes from the Texas Constitution, Article 8, Section 2. In our disparate rate claim under City of Texarkana versus Wiggins, the Texas Supreme Court explained that that comes from the common law. So even under their new definition, we'd still qualify. But I want to point out, because I think this is fundamentally important, a statutory property right is protected by the Due Process Clause. I don't think we have to think all that hard about that. I don't think your honors would think that your Texas retirement benefits can be taken away without due process simply because they come from Title 8 of the Government Code, nor my driver's license because it comes from Title 7 of the Transportation Code. Property rights are largely defined by state law, state statutes, and that's why it should come as no surprise that the United States Supreme Court in Logan versus Zimmerman Brush Company clarified that a statutory cause of action, there a discrimination claim under the Illinois Fair Pay Act, was a property right to which due process attached. And this isn't a novel theory. As the court may know, the city itself litigated an EDJA case before this court a few years ago. And in that case, it involved private rights as well, but they appeared and had notice. And so it wasn't strictly a due process challenge. But what they argued is that if the EDJA applies to private rights, it would violate the Constitution. And in arguing that case, which is now before the Texas Supreme Court, they too made the distinction between private and public rights, and they told the court in its briefing, contrasting generalized public rights, which are held in common by all taxpayers, from, and now I'm quoting, a taxpayer's personal right under the tax code to challenge a tax levied directly on him. That's our case. And that is what everyone agrees is a private right.
This may be a little bit of a rabbit trail, so don't spend a lot of time on it. Is there any significance to the fact that the pool of entities treated differently under the rate ordinance isn't all based upon religious distinction? I mean, presumably you've got some nonprofits in there that don't have a religious flavor to them or a constitutional protection that's as clear. Are those guys lumped in the same way? Yeah, the Magnolia Bulldog Booster Club, if it's a nonprofit, you know, does that matter?
I think it just means that they have different private rights. We've asserted a tax exemption that's not based on religious properties. We've asserted a discrimination claim that's based on reasonableness and a cost basis. We've also asserted a TRIFRA claim that is further unique to us. So I don't think it's just the TRIFRA claim that sets us apart. The tax exemption is a property interest. The declaratory judgment action is a property interest under the Due Process Clause. And so there's distinction, sure, but for due process purposes, no.
But when you get back into the tax issue, you get closer to being a public right. But I guess the distinction there is it's that individual's payment of tax as opposed to standing as a taxpayer. Is that the distinction?
That's right, because the injury is imparted separate and apart from the taxpayer base. These are in fact, not taxpayers. They're those that are accorded a separate treatment. And just to finish up on the private-public rights distinction, the city draws its new distinction. This statutory rights are immune from due process argument from a line of Supreme Court cases that have not a thing to do with due process. Oil states, Stern versus Marshall, those have to do with when you have a federal regulatory scheme, whether Congress can designate non-Article III, non-judicial forums to litigate disputes. That's a separation of powers question, and it's entirely different from the one we have here, which is when the legislature, the Texas legislature, has given the churches a judicial forum for their disputes, which it's done in the Declaratory Judgment Act and through TRIFRA, whether then, once that property right has come about, can the city unilaterally deprive them of that judicial forum by inadequate notice? And we have cases dealing with that. That's Mullane. It's all the Supreme Court cases. It's in Ray ER, and the answer is no. Because of that due process violation, any argument that the EDJA trumped our grounds for new trial or precluded the Rule 329 basis for new trial is plainly meritless, because that's what happened in Ray ER. I do want to turn briefly to the city's arguments about Rule 329 and the EDJA. That they draw this preclusion from the finality provision in the EDJA, which is that a non-appealed final judgment is, or non-appeal judgment is final. We think that's consistent with Rule 329 because every motion for new trial under Rule 329 is to a final non-appeal judgment within the 2 years post-fact. And so there's nothing fundamentally inconsistent about that. More importantly, the legislature, and EDJA is no exception, knows how to exempt Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. You can look at Section 1205.069, in which they've specifically excluded Rule 254 from the EDJA, but not a single word about new trials or Rule 329, which is further still important because the Texas legislature knows how to exempt Rule 329 as well.
Can you quickly address the third issue of even if the court had plenary power, even or we believe that 329 and the EDJA are not mutually exclusive, why your clients have a meritorious defense?
Two responses to that, Your Honor. First is that under the Due Process Clause, if the court agrees with us on that, it relieves us of the burden to prove the meritorious defenses. But if the court were to disagree with us on due process, but nevertheless find a procedural route for the Rule 329 motion, I want to be clear that we did have an evidentiary basis for our defenses. The tax exemption claim and the unreasonableness of the water rate claim, we offered the rates themselves and the city official statements explaining the bare purpose of recouping taxes. And we think that is sufficient evidence for those. On the TRIFRA claim, I want to be clear, we did offer a declaration, this clerk's record 1121, from the pastors laying out as a testimonial basis the religious liberty interests. And I, in my short time I have left, I want to point out how important the adversarial process is and how this is a microcosm of that. Because here we had a judge who, not presented with the church's arguments, signed a final judgment, and in a show of humility, once he was confronted with those arguments, he found differently. And so it just drives home, may I finish, Your Honor?
Sure.
The point that the churches ought to be accorded the fundamental requisite of due process, which is the opportunity to be heard.
Can I ask you, while you're on that point, not to kill your beautiful ending, but Mr. Parker would have us believe that they have all these other opportunities and other litigation once you all overcome the res judicata aspect of this order. What's your response to that?
As to the venue and how to challenge it, we certainly could have challenged it collaterally by way of res judicata, but we don't dispute that the EDJA as a statutory matter or that venue in Travis County is proper. And so a direct challenge within the time limits of Rule 329 or otherwise is a proper basis. And to get to your point, Chief Justice Rose, we have intervened in the EDJA action once the trial court granted that motion for new trial, and we fully intend to litigate these questions anew upon being sent back.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Ms. Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, I'd like to focus on the three propositions in this record that make the case both straightforward and easy to affirm. First, the church's claims are based on their private rights, not taxpayer standing. Second, the it's undisputed that the churches were known claimants in the Mullane framework, so they were entitled to notice, something better than newspaper publication under Mullane and In Re ER. And third, it's undisputed here that the churches didn't receive actual notice of this EDJA claim. Without all three of those elements, then there would not be the due process violation that we have in this case. To Chief Justice Baker's question, I would agree with the churches that the most straightforward way to decide this case is on due process. Were the court to get into the state law statutory interpretation, whether the EDJA allows for a Rule 329 motion, the court would, the court could find that the churches had a meritorious defense and were entitled to a new trial in that way. And so that's certainly an appropriate way to decide the case. But if the court were to disagree with the churches and find that they did not satisfy the basic Rule 329 good cause standard with the two prongs, then the court would need to reach the due process question anyway. because under In re, ER, and Mullane, and a host of other cases that have been cited, the court, Texas statutory procedures cannot overcome due process. If there's a due process violation, then the statute has to yield. So while we disagree with our friend's statutory interpretation, the court would still need to reach that question anyway. So the same three reasons that render this case a straightforward affirm are also reasons why it is unusual. The Attorney General's office has not seen cases like this in the EDJA. The court doesn't need to be worried about a sort of potential parade of horribles like as outlined in appellant's briefing because this is unlikely to happen again. These are private rights claims, and the prototypical EDJA litigation is about public rights claims, the validity of the bonds, whether the issuer had lawful authority to set the rate ordinances. For instance, the Leonard v. Cornyn case that my friend relies on, that's a case where the taxpayer argued that there was an insufficient electoral process to approve bonds. That's a classic taxpayer standing claim, and so in that case, the court decided that there was no liberty or property interest at issue. And so newspaper notice sufficed. As the churches noted, the taxpayer standing definition that appellants offer is based on a fundamental misunderstanding of the public rights question that's at issue here. They're citing cases that have to do with federal court's jurisdiction under the federal constitution, a separation of powers issue, not fundamental procedural due process to which the churches were entitled. We know that because in the Taylor v. Sturgill case from the United States Supreme Court, the court talked about the public rights question that's at issue here, the due process question. In that case, Taylor v. Sturgill, the argument was made that the Federal Freedom of Information Act is a just a public right, and so it doesn't get full due process protections because everybody has a statutory right to ask for FOIA information. The court rejected that argument out of hand. The fact that everybody has the right to invoke a statute like RFRA, like any other statutory claim, does not mean it is a public right for purposes of due process. When the judgment inures to the benefit of the individual because it's based on an individual injury, that is a private right. Your Honors, the court should affirm, and unless there are further questions, I'll yield my time.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. Mr. Parker?
Thank you, Your Honor. The narrowest basis, going back to Justice Baker's question, and I think it's the right one because the court should not go out of its way to discuss constitutional issues, especially where the constitutional issue wasn't jurisdictional in the district court. The narrowest basis is simply to look at 1205.002, that in the case of an inconsistency between this statute and any other statute or rule, the EDJA controls. There is plainly an inconsistency between the EDJA and Rule 329. Contrary to what the churches say, you don't need to go down and list every statute that trumps. Otherwise, the legislature would have to go back and amend 1205.002 after every session and add or subtract new statutes all the time. No, every statute that is inconsistent is the EDJA controls over that statute. That's the correct basis. That's the reason why this district court did not have jurisdiction, and it's certainly the narrowest basis on which the court can decide. Counsel talked about a void judgment, said that this is a void judgment because it's constitutionally infirm.
Can I ask on your first point? I
mean, yes, Your Honor.
Can't you have that be the case, but yet still due process carries the day in how the case resolves?
No, Your Honor, for exactly this reason. If on a due process issue, because of a due process violation, then the judgment is void. That's right. Now, of course, there's not a due process issue here, but if there were a due process problem, the judgment would be void. The way that you address that is you don't go and say, I'm going to move for a new trial in a district court that no longer has jurisdiction. I'm not going to seek declaratory judgment in that court in Zanzibar. No, what you say to me is, well, your judgment isn't worth the paper it's printed on. It's a void judgment, and I'd like to see you enforce it. And then when we try to enforce it, either through seeking summary judgment out in Montgomery County on the basis of res judicata, or seek to enforce it here by enforcing a permanent injunction, either way, that's when you bring up the fact that it's a void judgment. And those courts have jurisdiction to decide whether this is a void judgment or a valid judgment. Who doesn't have jurisdiction is the district court that issued that final judgment after its plenary power has expired. That court no longer has jurisdiction to decide that issue. In this case, though, the judgment, if we want to have that coffee shop debate, this judgment is a valid judgment because the dichotomy here is not between private rights and taxpayer standing. The dichotomy here is between private rights and public rights. And in those pair of very recent Supreme Court cases, Supreme Court Oil States case and the Stern versus Marshall case, the Supreme Court recognizes that they have been a bit muddled in how they discuss that dichotomy. But fundamentally, you know how I know when it's a public right is if the legislature through statute opened the door to that right. And if the legislature can close the door, then it's a public right. That's what the Supreme Court has said in Stern and in Oil States. And it can halfway close the door, as it did with copyrights, which are a public right. It's copyright under the Copyright Act. So you don't go to an Article III court and get your full due process. You get some kind of vaguely due process in the Patent and Trades Office. And on the EDJA is the same thing. It adjudicates public rights. Everything that can be brought up through the EDJA is a public right, and this is no different. RFRA is a public right. Before the legislature enacted RFRA, there was no right, and if the legislature repealed it tomorrow, there would be no due process right to sue the legislature for repealing it.
So then what's the effect of if a EDJ action ends up trampling a private right?
When the private right holder
never had the opportunity to participate.
I don't think it can, Your Honor, because there is no private right that could be adjudicated in an EDJA action. There's nothing that would be within the EDJA, within the scope of the statute, could be a private right. RFRA is a public right because of statute, and their other claims are public rights because, as the court can see from their Montgomery County plea, they rely on the Declaratory Judgments Act. And the Declaratory Judgments Act is also a public right when asserted against the government because it's a waiver of governmental immunity. And it's that same thing. When a public right is granted by the legislature can set the terms and the conditions for how that public right is adjudicated. It can say, with that public right, go to court, go to the district court. It can say, go over here to the PUC. Or, as we know, it can say, we're just not waiving governmental immunity. And as set forth in the Holmes case, the waiver of governmental immunity, or the decision by the legislature not to waive governmental immunity, does not violate due process. So this is a valid judgment. This adjudicated nothing but public rights. And the legislature set the terms and conditions for adjudicating those public rights in the EDJA. The judgment was granted by the district court. It is final. And the district court had no jurisdiction to grant a new trial outside of the primary power. And so that decision, Your Honor, on that narrow grounds, should reverse the district court's judgment for lack of jurisdiction and reinstate its final judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parker. Thank you to all counsel. It's a well-argued case with a lot of interesting issues. The case will be submitted, and the court will stand in recess. Thank you all.